We are talking about a water diversion plan for Foxconn Technology Group. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We learned Friday that a judge ruled in favor of Racine's plan to divert millions of gallons of water from Lake Michigan. And this ruling upheld Racine's plan to sell water to the village of Mount Pleasant for the Foxconn factory, meeting requirements of the Great Lakes Compact. So we're going to get into all of this. Do you agree with the judge's decision? Should Foxconn have the right to use Lake Michigan water? Are you an environmental advocate? What do you think of this decision? We're at 800-642-1234. Keith Hawes is general manager of the Racine Wastewater Utility. Keith, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. So what does this judge's ruling mean? What does this decision change for the city of Racine?
Well, for the last 18 months, we've been in an application process to divert Lake Michigan water to the Des Plaines watershed for the village of Mount Pleasant. And this latest ruling opens the door once again for that to happen.
Who do you see benefiting from this decision? Is this a good thing for the people of Mount Pleasant? Is this a good thing for Racine?
Well, I think it's a good thing for the region. Racine and Mount Pleasant, the area in southeast Wisconsin between Kenosha and Milwaukee, has been starved for decades for new development. We sit in Racine watching Oak Creek and Franklin grow and Kenosha grow leaps and bounds, and nothing has happened in Racine for likely 5 decades except for industrial decay, I guess I would say. So this is a bright spot in the area and some of the first good news we've had in decades.
Because you see the ripple effect from what Foxconn will build?
Yes, there's talk of hotels going up, additional warehousing, some hospitals are knocking on the door. So this is a breath of fresh air for the entire economy down here, as well as the region.
Help us understand, Keith, why did Racine need state approval to divert water from the Great Lakes Basin?
So when the Great Lakes Compact was passed in 2008, they have a provision for straddling counties, which is what Waukesha's application was, which needs the 7 Great Lakes states in the U.S. and Canada to agree to. And they also then dealt with a provision for what's called a straddling community. So the community of Mount Pleasant is straddling the subcontinental divide, and a large portion of the village is in the Lake Michigan watershed and a small portion in the Des Plaines watershed. So the each state then was granted the ability to pass legislation on how a straddling community would be dealt with. And a straddling community is dealt with in the state that it resides, as opposed to getting permission from all 7 Great Lakes states. So the state of Wisconsin has a provision for straddling communities. New Berlin, Wisconsin was the first state, well, the first city to apply for and receive Lake Michigan water a few years ago under that straddling community provision. And now Mount Pleasant would be the second village in the state to do so.
We're talking with Keith Hawes, general manager of the Racine Wastewater Utilities, talking about a judge's ruling that came out Friday, siding with Racine's plans to divert millions of gallons of water from Lake Michigan for the Foxconn plant. What do you think about diverting water from Lake Michigan? Do you agree with the judge's decision? Should Foxconn have the right to use Lake Michigan water? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Keith, we heard from a staff attorney for Midwest Environmental Advocates, Tressie Camp, and the firm represented the environmentalists who've argued against diverting Lake Michigan water for Foxconn, and she says her clients will appeal.
So certainly until we analyze and see more diversions, we won't know for sure, but I think, you know, the major issue here is whether or not this sets precedent.
So what happens if there is an appeal made against this administrative judge's ruling?
Well, we have not slowed down, I guess I'd say. We've been building water mains for the past 18 months, and a few of them are in the diversion area, and their appeals are appropriate, and this could be appealed for many years and keep going. I'm not sure that the precedent that they're worried about is much to worry about. 7 million gallons a day is what the diversion application asked for, but that's a maximum. And I doubt that I'll be selling anywhere near that in the next few decades through water conservation and other means and methods of manufacturing.
Well, one of the concerns is that 2.7 million gallons per day will not be returned to the Great Lakes Basin, largely due to evaporation. Is that a concern?
Not really, because we make up a lot of the water. We, on an average day here in the water utility, we might sell 13 million gallons, and on an average day at the wastewater plant, we might treat 20 million gallons or more. So we are always putting more water back in the lake than we are taking from the lake. So this net negative or net positive really would be pretty insignificant in the entire Great Lakes Basin, or Lake Michigan as itself, as it is a huge water body. For anybody that's ever crossed it in a sailboat, a ferry, or a motorboat, it is very vast. And at this time, we're experiencing and will likely break the all-time record in 150 years of the elevation of Lake Michigan this year. So we're in a very wet period, and even in a dry period, the lake may go up or down 5 feet in 20 years. But in 150 years of record, it hasn't wavered in more than 5 feet.
Keith Haas, you know, for the past year and a half, Racine's been putting in, as you mentioned, these water mains, building infrastructure to do this diversion. Can you tell us about what that infrastructure has meant to Racine, what it looks like, what the investment is?
There are a lot of orange barrels in Racine and Mount Pleasant and Sturtevant this year. And the village is moving forward with not only water main construction, but sewer main construction. The Department of Transportation is beginning to now work on, as they have worked on 14 miles of Interstate 94 in the last 18 months, they are now moving into the local highway structures in the Mount Pleasant region and area. So the infrastructure goes in first, water, sewer, roads, and then the manufacturing is tied to move in after the infrastructure is in place. As well as high-pressure gas, low-pressure gas. We energy's on the electric side, so it has been a massive effort on all utilities and infrastructure to prepare this site for future development.
Well, let's squeeze in a call here with Sharon in Appleton. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I was just wondering, what kinds of chemicals will Foxconn be releasing into the water after they've done using it? And is our sewage system, so water treatment, able to deal with that?
Thanks. Yeah, thank you for the question, Sharon. Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, so good question. And we are meeting today for the first time with some of the engineers representing Foxconn in the U.S. Just to talk briefly about pretreatment standards in Racine as a locality. There are national standards. There are state standards. There are local standards. They will have to meet all of those standards. Their plan at this time, to my knowledge, is to use a process called zero liquid discharge, which essentially would precipitate any chemicals that don't meet our pretreatment standards locally, nationwide, or statewide into, let's say, a dust-type material, and then that material would be hauled off to a landfill somewhere in the country that would be appropriate for it. So at this point in time, we don't anticipate any higher discharges from this industry as any other industry in the state of Wisconsin or in the local region.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Keith Haas is general manager of the Racine Wastewater Utility. We've been talking about a judge's ruling that sided with Racine's plans to divert millions of gallons of water from Lake Michigan for the Foxconn plant. Coming up, students and faculty at the UW-Eau Claire have spent a decade studying the natural landscape of the Chippewa River Valley. We'll hear about what's been discovered about the region's history. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a project on the Chippewa River and how it informs how we study rivers all over. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. And over the past decade, the Chippewa River's origin story has come to light with a team of researchers at UW-Eau Claire and dozens of their students. We now know why the river does what it does and how its valley became a suitable place to establish the city of Eau Claire. And we can apply this model to studying other river systems. Did you participate in field research in college? What was that experience like? What questions do you have about our landscape's past? Join in at 800-642-1234. Doug Faulkner is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire, and he's co-authored a study on the geomorphology of the Chippewa River that's received a national award. Doug, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So this study of the Chippewa River and the surrounding valley has been going on for a decade. Why is it important to study the geomorphic characteristics of the river, looking super closely at topography and terrain? What clues will geography unlock?
Well, part of it, sort of the initial motivation, is just basic curiosity, curiosity to know how the landscape came to be. But more than that, how the landscape can be what its history is, and in the particular the case here, the history of the Chippewa River and its valley, informs us with regard to the state of the river today, because where the river is right now, what its characteristics are just sort of part of this history that continues to go on, and its past is relevant to its present.
So help us understand a little more, what is geomorphology?
Well, geomorphology, the term literally means the study of earth forms or land forms. And a particular branch of it is what's called fluvial geomorphology, where fluvial comes from the Latin word for river. So it's really the study of land forms that are the result of the action of rivers, or more broadly, flowing water. And what I study, the flowing water I study, is the Chippewa River.
The physical landscape in Eau Claire and the Chippewa River Valley, how has that evolved over time? What did this study find out?
Well, I have to go back quite a ways in time for this study. About 30,000 or so years ago, at least best we know.
Give or take.
Glaciers, yeah, give or take. Give or take 1,000 years, right? What's that among friends?
Yeah.
But a large ice sheet expanded out of Canada. And flowed into the upper part of the Chippewa River watershed. And ice, this glacial ice, stayed within the watershed probably until about, 13 or so thousand years ago. During that time, the lower part of the Chippewa River was a what's called a glacial meltwater stream, carrying flow during the warm time of the year, and lots of sediment coming out of the glaciers. And that was more sediment than the river could transport, and the river filled up its valley largely with sand and gravel. And since that time, the river has been carving down into those deposits of sand and gravel that were left as a legacy of the glaciers, and creating a landforms called terraces, bench-like landforms along the river, as the river has cut down to where it presently is today. And so it's a history that started with respect to our study, about 30,000 years ago. And we're mostly interested in what's happened during that time after the glaciers left and the river cut into these and eroded out these deposits of sand and gravel in its valley.
We're talking with Doug Faulkner. He's a professor of geography and anthropology at UW-Eau Claire. We're talking about this decade-long research project studying the Chippewa River. Doug, how are UW-Eau Claire students involved in the research on the Chippewa?
Well, they've been involved in a number of ways. The initial work on this was doing some basic mapping of the landforms that we're interested in, the stream terraces I mentioned. And that just involved analyzing, interpreting topographic maps and other kinds of maps called digital elevation models, and doing a mapping on computers using a kind of software called GIS software, geographic information software. And then it entailed field work to field check the mapping that we did, interpreting topographic maps and these other digital elevation models. And students were involved in parts of this along the way. And then acquiring some samples of a material, this sand and gravel deposits, for a kind of analysis called optically stimulated luminescence, a big word, OSL. It's a way of determining how long ago or how long has it been since the deposits of sand last were exposed to sunlight. really, when were they deposited?
You also used some aerial maps and had some aha moments through those. What did you find out?
Well, you know, you start seeing, for example, patterns on these surfaces, on the stream terraces that indicate what the river was doing in the past. For example, when the river was this glacial meltwater stream, you know, 20 or so thousand years ago, it had a very different character from what it has today. Today, it's kind of a meandering stream, one channel. Back then, it was what's called the braided river, had a very different character. And it's evolved since that time to what it is today.
Has there been some narrowing of the river over the last, you know, seven decades or so? And does that have anything to do with an invasive aquatic plant?
Well, that's a good question. That was a study that's somewhat separate from the other work we've done over this long term. But we've also looked at the changes in the river over that period of time, about the last seven decades, just analyzing aerial photos. And we've seen that the channel of the river has gotten significantly narrower between Eau Claire and Durand. And it seems that, at least in part, that's the result of a plant called reed canary grass, which is a very invasive plant along a lot of water bodies in the state. And it was a surprising result, something I didn't expect to find, that this grass would have an effect on channel form, but it certainly appears to have. There's a lot more work to be done there to determine that, but that was a very interesting finding, unexpected.
In this study, you recently won a national award, which was noteworthy as a regional university and the lion's share of a lot of this work being done by undergrads. How do you and your colleagues teach students through this research and allow them the ownership of the results?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. But it goes right to the heart of what we do here at UW-Eau Claire, both in my department and actually departments across the university, which is to get students involved in collaborative research with faculty. That is true research. It's going out and creating new knowledge and testing what we think we know. This award, I think, pointed to both the tradition and the effort we put into getting students involved and doing true research. This would not have been done without student involvement, both in the research itself, but also, I have to say, the students largely fund this research. They pay a differential tuition to support undergraduate student faculty collaboration in research at UWEC. And so they played a very major role across the university, really, in this paper and the award that sort of acknowledged the work and the findings that came out of it.
So in your work studying the Chippewa River, how is that a new way of looking at river evolution and how we can look at other rivers around us?
Well, our millennial sort of evolution of the river, millennial scale, something that's been going on for thousands of years, it was a surprising result. It shows that something that happened, during that period of time, 20 to 30,000 years ago with the glaciers in the watershed. And since that time, that the rivers, this history that I mentioned, continue to respond to these major climatic changes that happened long ago. It's not really been documented for a river of this scale in the past. And it provides a model for rivers elsewhere in similar situations, and many rivers were affected by glaciation at that period of time long ago, and showing how to understand, like I said before, the modern river really takes understanding what the history of the river has been.
Well, in the last few moments here, do we know everything about the Chippewa River? Where does this research go from here?
No, far from it, actually. I should say job security, it gives me something to do. But the study, while I think it uncovered some really interesting things. I'm very proud of it, the work that we did with our students. It probably raised more questions than it answered. Led us to a place where we can now make more testable hypotheses, place more testable hypotheses, and continue researching how the river, not just the river itself, but its tributaries, continue to evolve through time.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Doug Faulkner is a geography and anthropology professor at UW-Eau Claire. He co-authored a study on the geomorphology of the Chippewa River, and he joined us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. Coming up, we head to France, where the Women's World Cup is underway, and our own WPR colleague is on the ground taking in games, and we'll hear about what to watch for as Team USA defends its title. Let's talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Taste of Paris. We're talking about the Women's World Cup and women's soccer on the international stage. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the U.S. women's national team is considered one of the most successful in history. Team USA has 3 World Cup titles, including from the first ever Women's World Cup held in 1991. That bit of history sets us up for what we're seeing on day 6 of World Cup action. We have our eye on that 24-year-old midfielder, Rose Lavelle. She's a former Badger, the most decorated player in UW soccer history, scored twice against Thailand yesterday. And our own Judith Sears-Poisson is taking it all in. She is executive producer of WPR's Central Time, joining us from Paris and enjoying the World Cup festivities. Judith, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Kate, I'm really happy to do it.
So what is it like in Paris right now? Set the mood for us.
Sure. Well, in the center of the city, I haven't actually seen much as far as obvious fans, I'd say, but it's a big city. It's during high tourism season, and the stadium, which is Parc des Princes, is pretty far to the west of the city, but it is being talked about a lot on, say, the morning TV shows, and not just what's going on in Paris, but in the other 8 cities that are hosting games, too. It's really from north to south, east to west in the country. At the opening match on Friday night, it was a really festive atmosphere. Lots of families with kids of all ages, lots of little ones even, and it felt like there were about an equal number of men and women there as fans. Not surprisingly, I'd say nearly everyone was there to support France. It was the opening match with the home team, but there was a noticeable block of South Korean fans too, and it was just a really positive, friendly environment. There was no booing. You know, there were clapping for good plays made on both sides. I will say security was very tight, given the fear that an event like this could be the object of a terrorist attack. I don't know if people remember, but the night of the Bataclan attacks in 2015, that actually started with suicide bombers at Stade de France, that's to the north of Paris, during a friendly soccer match between France and Germany. So pat downs of all of the 45,000 people that went in.
Yeah, so 45,000 people, the stands have been pretty full, would you say?
Certainly for the opening match, I think they said that, of course, the different stadiums have different capacities. I think Parc des Princes in Paris is probably one of the largest, but they've been averaging about 18,000 to 20,000 fans for every game. The one I was at on Monday night, which was Argentina, Japan, that was 25,000 people, which at 6 o'clock on a Monday, it was a holiday here, but still, I thought that was a really good turnout.
You talked to a lot of people about how they're feeling about the World Cup, and you asked some middle schoolers whether they think people are right who say that male athletes are stronger than female athletes, and here's what they had to say.
No.
Les filles sont plus fortes.
Mais aussi parce que le foot masculin, ça commençait avant.
Judith, tell us about your conversation there with these sixth graders. What do they have to say?
That was so lucky. I went to the Institute of the Arab World because they had an exhibit on the role of soccer in the Arab world, and this class of sixth graders were there. Both the boys and the girls said that they were really excited to support the women's team, even though they said they really don't know the individual players like they do the men's. They said that if it was easier to, for instance, see the games on TV, they would love to do it. They are all really hoping that France, the French women's team, earns their first star on their jerseys by winning the cup, and they said they're sending all their good thoughts and all their strength to them.
You've had some other conversations, and you talked with a gardener. What was that like?
Yeah, so the Luxembourg Gardens are one of the biggest green spaces in Paris, and I was walking through, and there was a crew of gardeners there, and I just went up to them and asked if I could talk with them. Two of the three guys said they weren't really soccer fans, so the third one became the representative for the group. But he said that, you know, given the chance, he too would watch and enjoy women's soccer just as much as men's. It just hasn't been given the same exposure. He really kind of blamed, you know, marketing and media for that. And he said that to him, the players are equally strong and talented. And he really thinks that women deserve as much of a chance to make a living as a professional soccer player as the men's do. He thought that soccer, like in other parts of life, he said, would be better if it was feminized more, that women had equity and played an equal role.
And equity has been coming up in the World Cup. We also looking at treatment of female players. How aware are people you've talked with about these issues? And does it color it out how they're experiencing these games?
You know, some people, like the man I spoke to at Luxembourg Gardens, are definitely aware of the inequities. We talked a little bit. He was happy to hear that the U.S. women were suing, that there had been the other efforts to bring more equity in pay and in treatment. I don't know if it's really coloring how people are seeing the games. It's certainly been on my mind. And watching the game, for instance, on Monday night, I kept thinking, you know, that these players, whatever team wins the World Cup, they will receive as their prize money 7.5% of what the men last year won. I mean, not even 10%. And that it just shows such a lack of respect, I think, for the players and for the game.
Well, Judith, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. I'm back to vacation now, and I've got another match tomorrow night, and then back to Madison.
Judith Sears-Poisson is executive producer of WPR Central Time, and she joined us from her travels in Paris. So we're carrying on with our look at Women's World Cup. FIFA just announced that it reached an important milestone with over 1 million tickets allocated to fans worldwide. Let's bring in Roger Gonzalez. He's a writer for CBS Sports. Roger, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So we're on day six. What have you seen as the biggest moment so far? What have you been watching out of Women's World Cup?
Yeah, it's certainly what the U.S. women were able to accomplish yesterday. I mean, to win 13-0, the most lopsided victory in World Cup history, both men or women, really a performance that you could see coming from a mile away, just because the U.S. played Thailand a few years ago, beat them 9-0. They just showed no mercy in a game that I don't think anyone who saw it will ever forget. And so the U.S. has stole the headlines early on with what they showed, and you know, it sets up for a really nice rest of the tournament.
Well, even when you saw Thailand come out and saw the Team USA come out, I mean, they even look quite different. It's not evenly matched at all.
No, it's not. It's like night and day. And this feels like, you know, having the, you know, a really professional team playing against an amateur team in a sense. It's just so different in regards to the development that these players have, how long they've been playing, the coaching that they receive, the skill that they just have naturally. It's a huge gap that you don't see that too much in the sport, especially on the men's side. It's something that we saw on the men's side years ago when there was huge disparity between the talent levels. But for the women's game with, you know, the different zones in the world, how teams get through qualification, it sets up for these games to be at times very lopsided. I think in 2007, Germany beat Argentina 11-0. And you think, whoa, Argentina, it's a, you know, a significant big country. And that's a team that really is very behind when it comes to developing the women's game. And they've made some progress, but it was nothing compared to what we saw in this one. I mean, the U.S. had 40 shots. They could have won by 20 goals. It was Oh, it makes you almost feel a little bit bad for the tie just because of how lopsided it was.
Yeah, Roger. So how does the structure of Women's World Cup work in terms of the tournament, and how is it different from the Men's World Cup?
All right. So in the Women's World Cup, there are 24 teams. So you have six different groups with four teams each. And usually in tournaments, you'd like to have the top two teams from each group move on, and then that's it. Then you play knockout rounds. But for this tournament, because of the because there aren't eight groups, and that would only mean 12 teams going through, to get to 16 teams in the knockout stage, you also have four of the six third-place teams. So the four best third-place teams move on, and that sets up 16 teams, win or go home, all the way to the title. And that differentiates from the men's game, that right now there's 32 teams in the men's game, and basically eight groups, and the top two go through. So it's a little simpler just because of the numbers. The men's game is expanding to 48 teams for the 2026 World Cup, which will be in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And hopefully we can see the women's game at some point expand a bit, too, to get to a number that maybe works a little bit easier.
Talking with Roger Gonzalez, a writer for CBS Sports, we're looking at Women's World Cup and what we're seeing out of France. Roger, which teams should we be watching for right now? Who are the front runners at this point?
Yeah, it starts with the U.S. just because they are the reigning champs. And like you said, you know, with three World Cup trophies, only two countries have multiple. The U.S. leading the way with three. And then you look at Germany with two. Germany's, I think you put them up there as one of the top three contenders to win based on that history. They have some injury issues, but they certainly have more than enough to win the competition. And then I'd also throw France in there as the host, though they have never won, but it's huge being at home and having that advantage. They've got really some fantastic players that I think any team in the world would love to have. They have a defender, Wendy Renard, who's 6'2", just a towering figure, who scored two goals in the first game as a defender. She's just so good in the air. And then England is the last team I'd really throw in there as a contender, a country that has improved quite a bit in the women's game and has really high aspirations this time around.
Well, Team USA fell to Sweden. What do we see out of Sweden?
Yeah, so Sweden's an interesting team.
This in the Olympics.
Yeah. Right, right. And that has created a little bit of a rivalry between the two. And you, you had former U.S. goalie Hope Solo call Sweden cowards after how they played in that game. It's created quite a bit of tension. And so when the draw came out that the U.S. would be playing Sweden, that was certainly a game everyone had their eyes on. And Sweden's one of those teams that has had a lot of success in this tournament before, similar to Norway and China in the sense that, you know, back in the day they were considered a potential power, but have since not necessarily faded a bit. Maybe it's been the emergence of other countries, but they certainly haven't been at the level of, you know, of a U.S. Or a Japan in recent years. But yeah, I mean, that's a game that everyone has their eyes on, U.S. Sweden in the last group stage game that should be with both of them tied on 6 points and the winner going through.
U.S. has some work to do there to resolve past history. Talking Women's World Cup underway in France with Roger Gonzalez, a writer for CBS Sports. Do you plan on traveling to France to see any of the matches? What's your favorite thing about soccer? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Yes, we're talking World Cup Day 6 here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Team USA has been waiting 4 years to defend its title. After winning the World Cup in 2015, team fell to Sweden as we were talking about the Olympics in 2016. So what is your favorite thing about soccer? Did you play soccer as a youth or now as an adult? What attracts you to the sport, and what are your thoughts on the U.S. women's team equal pay lawsuit? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Roger Gonzalez is our guide. He's a writer for CBS Sports, and he stays with us. Roger, got to talk Rose Lavelle, 24-year-old midfielder out of UW-Madison. She is on fire. She two goals yesterday against Thailand. What do we know?
Yeah, she's a great player. I mean, she has so much potential, and I think will be one of the faces of this team entering the next World Cup when she's more in her prime, and some of these older players maybe shift away from the roles that they have. But you know, she's ready now, and she's such a complete player who plays well beyond her age. I think she's a difference maker, as we saw, someone who plays with a lot of confidence. And I think U.S. fans have a lot of reasons to be excited for what she brings to the table now and into the future.
There have been concerns, though, about injuries. I mean, she's had some setbacks there.
Yeah, she looked like she picked up a little knock after landing awkwardly in the game against Thailand, but fought on. And that's one of the characteristics that she shows, that she's tough. She tries not to come out of a game if she doesn't have to. Someone who obviously doesn't like to come out because of how much she wants to be on the field. And it's nice that the U.S. hasn't had to deal with some of the injury issues that other teams have had at this tournament. They seem healthy entering the next game, and that's obviously key. But yeah, Rose, as you alluded to, I mean, someone who I think really has the chance to be one of the very best players on this team, and the progression that she's made has been pretty incredible to watch.
Yeah, certainly missing her here at UW-Madison. So, a player from Norway, Ada Hegerberg, has made headlines for her decision not to play at the World Cup this year. And Hegerberg is widely considered the best female soccer player in the world. Why won't she make an appearance?
Yeah, it's been interesting. She has had a dispute with the federation, hasn't been very vocal about it, but she's been trying to fight for just having equality for the women's game in Norway. Similar in a sense, maybe, to what we see in the U.S. in regards to just trying to fight for what they feel is rightfully that they rightfully deserve. And so she's someone obviously with a huge platform, having been awarded the award as the world's best player. So for her to not play certainly makes quite the statement. She's there in France working. She's doing something TV related. And for someone who still has a lot of years ahead of her, to skip the World Cup has certainly made lots of headlines. And she's using it as a chance to stand up and fight for what she believes in. So it's certainly an admirable cause, and something that she has been hasn't been as vocal about. People would like to know a bit more details as to what specifically. But she's trying to fight for what she wants.
Well, gender equity has been coming up. The U.S. women's team sued the U.S. Soccer Federation this spring over equal pay. What do we know about this lawsuit?
Well, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, the latest chapter a few months ago comes right before the tournament, which, I don't think is any coincidence. I think it makes perfect sense for them to bring it back into the spotlight ahead of this tournament, where they, once again are trying to show exactly what they can do on the field and why they're deserving of more. And, it's been an issue for quite a while, the difference in, whether it's pay or, what they receive when it comes to the type of hotels. This is this is nothing that's going to end, I don't think, anytime soon. People thought maybe it'd be handled out of court. The U.S. Soccer Federation is standing firm and, pursuing, they're standing up legally in the courts to fight for, what they think. And very complicated situation when you're, suing your employer. And, really, I think it boils down to, what we've seen, in this country overall, just trying to get to a point where there is equal pay between men and women. We saw Chuck Schumer tweet about it specifically in regards to women's soccer yesterday. So, it's one of those things where I don't think it's going to be resolved anytime soon. The U.S. is doing, the players specifically are doing what they can to stand up for what they believe in. And hopefully in due time, we see some significant progress.
So why is the women's team so dominant on the world stage and seeing more success than the men's team? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. It doesn't necessarily boil down, I think, to one thing. I mean, I think first off, you have to note that, the U.S. Women's National Team have the most talent out of any team in the world. I mean, it's incredible. And, people wonder, why can't the men's team be like this? And I think there are a lot of differences. I mean, I think certainly while the U.S. women have, the best team in history, the most successful team on the men's side, perhaps at the very, very top, you see more competition when it comes to these countries having, played the game for so long. They're just kind of being more history there. But I mean, not to take away from the U.S. women at all, because what they've done is absolutely incredible. But I think, when you look at the U.S. men's team, you have really a decent level of talent, nowhere in comparison. They haven't come close to sniffing even, you know, close to anything close to winning a World Cup like the women have. I think with the women's game, you've got all these players. I feel like every little girl you know grows up playing soccer now and looks up to this U.S. women's national team. On the boys' side, perhaps there's, you know, whether it's, you know, baseball or football or lacrosse or all these other sports, some people think maybe the best athletes are not playing soccer. But for the U.S., they've led it, you know, winning the first World Cup, winning three, going for four. They are the gold standard in women's soccer. And, you know, something that the men would like to at someday accomplish. It just doesn't seem like they're going to come close anytime soon.
Talking with Roger Gonzalez, he's a writer for CBS Sports. We're looking at Women's World Cup in France underway with the Team USA beating Thailand yesterday quite handily, 13-0. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you appreciate about soccer? Did you play soccer as a youth or now as an adult? And what attracts you to the sport? What are you watching for out of Women's World Cup? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Roger, going way back in time, the Women's World Cup was founded right around 30 years ago. First games were held in China in 1991. The Men's World Cup has been around since 1930. Can you tell us about how the Women's World Cup got started and why didn't this happen, you know, until the 90s?
Yeah, it's something that people have asked me, you know, quite a bit about. And I think we saw, you know, with the men's game and the popularity, and especially in this country, there were, you know, there was a time where I was only just a few years old when that World Cup happened. But I remember my dad, who played professionally, telling me, you know, growing up in this country when he immigrated from Central America, that he would go play in all these leagues with friends on the weekends, and he would see, you know, some days he'd see some girls kicking the ball around. Then later on, he'd see more and more, and he could see the growth of the game in this country specifically. Hmm. And, you know, when you look back at, you know, just international women's soccer, you know, in the 1970s, there were some kind of unofficial tournaments. There were some in Mexico, some in Denmark. So there was a bit of a progression there, an excitement for trying to get something going on the women's side. I mean, to think, as you said, 1930 and taking all the way to 1991 to get the Women's World Cup, certainly much longer than anyone really thought. But it was just kind of a slow process because there was not a lot of there wasn't much of a foundation there for the sport in a lot of these different countries. So it took a while to, you know, they're far from catching up to the resources that there is on the men's side of the game. But it just wasn't, you know, very popular in a lot of these countries. And I think that's been something we've seen, you know, like, for example, with the Thailand women's national team. The sport hasn't been huge there on the women's side for a long time. And it's kind of evident by the resources that they have, the talent level that they have, that's going to take quite a while. But I think, you know, for the World Cup starting in 1991 and to see where the U.S. women's national team is right now, it's been an incredible amount of progression in such a short amount of time.
Roger, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Roger Gonzalez is a writer for CBS Sports. We've been talking about Women's World Cup. And earlier, we talked with our own WPR staffer, Judith Sears-Poisson, who joined us from Paris, where she's taking in the festivities. Just ahead, we talked to a doctor about his new book, Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.